The financial services game is changing, and banking as a service is leading the charge. We've interviewed some of the industry's biggest changemakers in our brand new six-part documentary video series, Decoding Banking as a Service, which has just launched on our YouTube channel. Jump inside the minds of some of the biggest names in the space and find out why BaaS is so hot right now and how your business can reap the benefits. To watch the current episodes and get instant updates when new ones are released, head to bit.ly/decodingBaaS. Okay, let's start today's show. From 11FS, this is FinTech Insider News. This week we bring you Stripe breaks into banking as a service with Stripe Treasury, GoHenry and Move complete new funding rounds, and Space Oddity as the Royal Mint sends a new David Bowie coin into space. All this and more on today's show. Welcome to episode 487 of FinTech Insider. I'm Sarah Kachansky, and today I'm joined by my colleague and co-host for today, Kate Moody. How are you doing today, Kate?
Yeah, I'm doing nicely, thank you. Our the 11FS team sent out some like little mini remote Christmas trees, so you can't actually see it on this, but I've got a nice Christmas tree buddy joining me in my little work from home space, which cheered me up a lot this week. So thank you very much to everyone who organised that.
Yes, it was rather amazing. These Christmas trees came through the letterbox. They were flat packed, and they're real. They're live foliage. But I opened the box and thought, what on earth am I looking at? Took me a while to get there. We are, of course, not alone. We are joined remotely by some awesome guests. So making his FinTech Insider debut, we have Alex Zivoda, CEO of GoHenry. Welcome to the show. How are you doing? I think you've had quite a good week.
Thank you, Sarah. Doing very well indeed. Quite a good week. I'm happy to be here because as I was telling your crew just before we started, Spotify told me last week that FinTech Insider is my number one podcast in 2020. It's the one I listen to the most. So I'm happy to be at last on stage and not just listening.
Oh, well, we are very flattered. It's great to know you listen to us. And also, you know what you're getting yourself into.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we are also joined by Wade Arnold, CEO of Move.io. Welcome to FinTech Insider. Also, a good week for you and the team. We'll get to that a little bit later on, but how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be on here and just thankful, Sam or Simon isn't on this call in order to make fun of me throughout the entire interview process.
That was a deliberate move. We wanted it to be a nice experience for you.
I appreciate that, Sarah.
If it's any consolation, I know you make a lot of fun of Sam, so I try and give it back to balance things out a bit.
Somebody needs to, that's for sure.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's get on with the show. So the first story today is that Stripe has announced an embedded business banking service called Stripe Treasury. The new product is brought to you in partnership with Goldman and Citi, and it will offer a banking as a service API. So a developer can take advantage of Stripe Treasury to enable customers to open bank accounts, move money and pay bills directly from their service by triggering Stripe's APIs. Combined with Stripe Issuing, clients can also issue a virtual or physical card and connect it to a bank account. Slowly Stripe is building products that cover a bigger chunk of the payment chain. Just an example here for you that Shopify has already announced that it will use Stripe Treasury for Shopify Balance. So if a Shopify merchant wants to hold money, pay bills, and spend money from their Shopify account, then they can open a bank account in Shopify Balance directly. So basically, they don't need to have a traditional bank account. Everything is handled within Shopify. So thoughts on this one? Who wants to go first?
I don't mind kicking us. I think we actually, when we recorded the show last week, this was just breaking, I think, before we recorded the show last week. So we've had a little bit of time now to start to see how people are reacting to this. And it's obviously, it's not a surprise that Stripe are continuing to launch innovative new products and interesting new partnerships. But I think this one definitely has created a bit of concern perhaps in some of the people that we've been speaking to. I think it's potentially prompting quite a lot of these bigger financial institution brands to really realize that banking as a service isn't just a nice topic you can talk about. It's something that you've actually got to have an approach for. You've got to be able to move. And obviously great to be joined by Wade so we can chat about what you guys do in this space as well. But I think this is just another recognition of the fact that, you know, you can't just talk about banking as a service. Now you have to actually be launching products and getting things out into the market, because otherwise Stripe, and I'm sure lots of other providers, are just going to come and eat up the opportunity space, which is building up.
Yeah, you know, I think Stripe is quite clearly perfectly positioned to have done this. It's a very complementary service to the rest of, you know, its suite of products. And obviously they have the tech know-how, understand the nuance, and also the resources to get it done, because I don't imagine it was a cheap or an easy build, this. Wade, Alex, any thoughts?
To me, the biggest winner here is Citi and Goldman. These are two established financial institutions that are super successful in commercial banking, but you don't really think, at least in the United States, of Citi or Goldman being a huge retail presence. And so to align themselves with Stripe as a distribution channel in order to grow that tight side of retail deposits, cheap deposits, non-interest income, is, to me, you know, the most brilliant piece of this announcement. From a Stripe side, what I've always enjoyed about Stripe is, you know, they are able, for a certain set of users, you know, as long as you look act like them, to have the most simple developer experience, turnkey experience. And so, you know, I'm just excited to see the proliferation of platform companies and marketplaces that have financial services embedded inside of them to create better user experiences. So bravo to them.
Alex, you know, is this? I can't tell whether you're looking skeptical or whether you're agreeing with what Wade's saying there.
I was agreeing with what Wade said. I was just thinking of Stripe and of Collison Patrick. What I like about Stripe, which is really really difficult to persistently get right, is the rigor and the focus. I mean, these guys are completely focused on what they do, which is actually, they don't want to become a bank. I don't think I see them anywhere, any day becoming a bank. But this idea, which I think Patrick phrased very clearly in one of the first interviews he did, probably actually with you guys, he stated it as Stripe is a permissionless global payments and network, treasury network. And this idea of like sticking to it and just doing that, that's fantastic. I mean, you see a lot of companies that after a little while, they start wading off into going off piste into some direction. These guys are just going after what they have said they would do from day one. Excellent. Congratulations to them. I think I don't know what will stop them, actually. I really don't know what will stop them.
I think just to add to that point, you know, about how, you know, world domination coming their way, obviously Stripe does operate in more than one country. It's not just in the US. And I think it looks like it's that they're going to look to be able to roll this this product out in other countries as well with other banking partners. Do you think that's something that banks should be in other countries should be putting their hands up? Do you think they should be saying, oh yeah, you know, this is me, you're coming to the UK, you know, pick me? Do you think there'll be competition from the banks to do this? Or do you think that, as you know, they could be quite skeptical about working with Stripe?
So for me, I've worked with Goldman and worked with the team at Citi as well. And, you know, their view of their platform and offering up their services is, you know, very thoughtful. And both of them being global banks allow for them to expand into other markets for Stripe. You know, to me, if I'm the competition, if I'm a different bank, I wouldn't be as afraid of Stripe as I would be of Goldman and Citi being willing to do partnerships both with directly with Stripe or through other channels, whether that's Lyft or Uber or Amazon. To me, that's the thing that other financial institutions need to be worried about is companies as progressive as Goldman and Citi going out and creating those partnerships and providing that as this high-end, high transactional treasury management that in 2020 we call banking as a service.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we've talked on recent weeks about, you know, the announcements around Google Plex and Google Pay. You know, that's obviously got partnerships with Citi, and we obviously, as you mentioned, Goldman have been partnering with Amazon. So yeah, I think the combination of all of these things together, I think, means that we're in a totally different position at the end of 2020 than we maybe were at the start of the year in terms of how, you know, rival banks will be thinking about their options now that these big players have made these moves and opened themselves up to these partnership models.
Yeah, I don't see any difference between city partnering with Google as a distribution channel and understanding that Google may be good at customer acquisition versus Stripe, you know, same platform that backs both of those service offerings.
It does show perhaps Citi and Goldman, I mean, we kind of already knew it about Goldman, but it does show Citi and Goldman perhaps as being quite progressive, you know, that they've gone for multiple partnerships here as well, where, you know, where other banks may have thought, oh, no, not sure about that. Or, I mean, I don't know which way around it was done. I don't know if Stripe approached Goldman, Goldman approached Stripe, you know, whether Stripe said, we're thinking of doing this and went round and, you know, did some first dates with people to see who it might work well with. But I think, you know, also, as we sort of commented here, I think it shows the banks in quite a good light as well. That they are willing, open, and progressive to doing these things.
Right. And both those institutions are not going to go down market. So I'm sure Goldman is perfectly happy helping Lyft and having that white glove approach and that opportunity. But why not partner with a banking as a service that has a great consumer brand like Stripe in order to take it to the masses? Mm-hmm.
What do you think will happen to, I mean, it's a question to all of us. What do you think will happen to the other banks? Because these are two global banks, right? Citi and Goldman. But what about the national bank? What about the local bank in the US? You have like thousands of them. What will that mean for them? Is Stripe, I mean, will Stripe become a partner or a threat to them? Or will there be a sort of alliance being built between all these banks as we have alliances in the sky? I mean, we had COVID, everyone is, all the planes are down. It's interesting. I mean, this could be a tectonic shift, this move by Stripe. So I think the next 5 years will tell us how the market reacts.
Yeah, I think to Wade's point, I think for Goldman and Citi, this is opening up a new market. But I think if you think about Shopify as the example, businesses, merchants on that platform will be able to open a bank account within one ecosystem. We've been doing various bits and pieces, like looking at who might be banking, who might have previously been banking those types of emerging businesses. And we did that as part of our sort of SMB research at the start of this year. And there was a whole mix, but we saw examples of local banks, emerging fintechs. We didn't really speak to anyone who was banking with Goldman or Citi. So I think, as you say, Alex, I think it's definitely going to be other banks that will be looking at this and worrying that potentially they might be losing out on customers who could have been growth businesses in the future, but they probably weren't doing a very good job necessarily in kind of capturing those banks already historically.
Well, definitely one to watch, I think. But with that, I'm just going to move us on to our next story. This is that UK-based kids bank account app GoHenry has raised $40 million. So the funds will be used to fund expansion in the UK and the US. For those not in the know, GoHenry, which was founded 8 years ago, offers accounts for children that are used by 1.2 million parents and children. Its mission is innovation in digital banking and payments and to revolutionize financial education to help 16 to 18-year-olds learn good money and financial habits in an increasingly cashless world. The company has doubled its customer base annually over the past 6 years and notably has been profitable since March of 2020. Through the GoHenry app, UK parents provided £98 million in pocket money in 2019. I think kids get more pocket money than I did. And their children were paid more than £2.2 million for completing tasks around the house. Also in 2019, GoHenry's young customers directly contributed just under £100 million to the UK economy, with children donating more than £53,000 to GoHenry's UK charity partner, the NSPCC. So, Alex, I think perhaps we'll come to you on this one first. First of all, congratulations, as we said. Secondly, can you tell us a bit more about this round and what you plan to do with the money, this time and perhaps beyond?
Yeah, thank you for the congratulations. It's an important milestone in our journey. It actually happened almost day for day, 8 years after the very first transaction of a kid named Henry. Hence GoHenry. We of course will be using the funds that we have now raised to continue our expansion in the US, which we launched there in 2018. So we've done a lot of tests over the last couple of years, and now we are ready to really scale and continue our scaling in the UK. But also explore new distribution, hence Citi coming in the round. Also exploring new countries, hence Gaia, who is a French private equity round coming in as well. So we are very happy because we have had a bit of an unusual story when you look at our funding story. We have been, as every startup, we have started with family's money, then friends and family's money, then friends of friends' money, and then we added Crowdcube, so the crowd, and we ended up with 5,000, two different rounds with 5,000 shareholders, half of which are our customers. And then we top it up now with, or we continue it rather, with the 40 million that we raised from the four funds. This is a great, and it's just the beginning of the story because the space is huge. If you just think of the UK and the US, in the UK there are about 6 million children who receive some pocket money every week. In the US, 39 million. So this is combined 45. And it's a market very diverse and diversifying. And we can talk about that a bit more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Does anybody else want to jump in and respond to any of Alex's points there? Or shall I lead?
Yeah.
You go for it, Kate.
No, well, yeah, firstly, I'd add my congratulations to Sarah. It's really exciting news for you guys. And I think, you know, we've always been super interested at 11FS in watching kind of the emergence of fintech provision for younger customers. And it's something that has obviously really exploded, particularly over the last few years, you know, in the US, the UK. Obviously, you know, you guys doing well with what you do, but, you know, Revolut also launching their junior proposition, Starling, Greenlight in the US, Rooster Money. So lots of different kind of players in this space. So it's exciting to see the industry starting to kind of think about how they can help children interact with kind of the you know, digital economy and kind of starting to manage money safely kind of through digital technology. So I think it's obviously super exciting for you guys individually, but I think also really interesting because it will obviously create the greater focus around this as an area and hopefully make, well, maybe not for you guys, but hopefully make some of your competitors sort of step up as well and really think about how they keep pace with you guys as you grow. So hopefully it will really kind of increase competition, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's clear. I mean, there wouldn't be this many people, companies entering this space if there wasn't an opportunity here. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what that opportunity actually is, because whilst providing financial education to children is an enviable goal, that's, you know, what's the wider business opportunity here with children? You know, where do we, is it the parents themselves, or is it, you know, getting the children on board as customers and then, you know, bringing them along for a journey with other financial services products as they get older? You know, maybe Alex, if you could talk a little about what GoHenry's sort of strategy is on that, as much as you can say publicly, and then we can have a discussion about, you know, maybe other competitors' strategies.
Sure. Yeah, I'm often asked this question. And probably some people are surprised to hear me reply that our sole focus is to help every child be good with money. So we are not going beyond that. And so it's already a very difficult job as such. Because when you think of it, take a child who is 6 and goes through to the age of 18, right? In these 10, 12 years, this child changes more than probably he will change after the rest of his life, right? So you have to build a product and you have to build a brand that can satisfy that child going through these two or three stages of evolution of themselves, their personality, the way they manage money, etc. So that's one. Second, you have to do the same for the parents, because we are selling our services to the parents, right? So the complexity of like creating this brand and creating this product that ages with the child, this is already a lot of work for the 160 people that we employ. And so when you ask a question about what's next, my reply is, well, let's first get that one right. We're not finished. We are just starting this journey. We're just starting this journey. And just on that journey, there is a lot to do, believe me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can see that. You know, Kate, Wade, do you see any other? Are there any other sort of obvious opportunities here that you see in this space that businesses can take advantage of?
So one thing Alex said about the community bank marketplace in the United States that I don't think Stripe has any risk of upsetting the community bank relationships in the U.S. I do think that products like GoHenry that redefine what a community is and can take those deposits away, to me, that's the real opportunity. By having, you said, 160 individuals, I assume that's going to expand, focused on a very defined market segment. You know, that community of youth is a very large community rather than the community of where I'm from, Bettendorf, Iowa, which, you know, is right off the Mississippi. And that's what defines our community. And that's in the logo of half the banks in that town, is a Mississippi bridge or river. And so I think as these service providers come in and really appeal to the niches that they can service better, that's going to be the new definition of what a community is. And to me, that risks the geographical community that has established the 15,000 banks and credit unions in the United States.
Yeah, Kate, did you want to add? Oh, sorry, Alex. I don't know who's going to go first.
I fully agree with Wade. And it is something that actually we, of course, we are focused on our mission, but we got to realize the power of our mission as we start implementing it and delivering it, right? So when you hear or when you read, let me take this example. When you read customers, parents, or children who are writing to us, we don't have a lot because we don't have a lot of children who are aged 17, 18, and 19, so basically who are leaving us because we don't offer them anything anymore, but who are writing to us saying, I have to go now. I would just like to say thank you for these years that we've been together. Thank you very much. I mean, you don't see, I don't think banks get this type of spontaneous mails from their customers, right? So that means that you are hitting a chord. Something is right. And yeah, I mean, our customers tell us they just love the product. They understand the value. Parents love it and kids love this empowerment. So I think we have, back to my comment first on Stripe, stay focused, rigorous on what you do, and wonders will happen.
Yeah, I think, I remember back when I was a kid, like the power of being able to spend and buy something yourself for the first time, that's a hugely memorable and kind of powerful moment. So yeah, I think the brand association you must have is incredibly powerful. I suppose that's why you must keep getting these questions about what do you do next, because people see the affinity that you have and they wonder how you carry that through. So in a previous life I used to do research with Nando's, who are kind of a popular restaurant here in the UK, and they focus on students and children and sort of sustain that through adult life in a slightly embarrassing way as someone in their 30s who still goes to Nando's. But yeah, so people are excited to see kind of whether you could take that brand relationship that you build with children, I suppose, and carry that through into student accounts or into those early years of professional life when money worries really start to become much more risky. We see so many young people kind of making bad decisions with credit, kind of really creating problems for themselves. So I suppose that must be why you get the questions that you get.
Yes. No, but these questions, of course, are very good. And I'm not saying that we will not do anything. But I'm just always, you have to put things in perspective. And you always have to think of today, right? The time. Time is the most precious resource of anyone, but in particular of an entrepreneur and of a company, right? How you spend your time, how you make your people spend their time, this is so critical. So if you start going into too many different places, you might lose what you have actually, what actually you are really made for. So we have a lab. Of course, we are testing ideas. And of course, we will come up next year with new ideas and you will invite me again to the show to talk about that. But what I'm saying is the following. You cannot have these ideas, they cannot go live unless you have the trust of your customers. Otherwise, you just forget about it. It makes no sense, right? You have to build a customer base. You have to build a relationship to your customer, which is such that they love you. Unless you achieve that, there is nothing your lab can produce better. So that's the key.
All right. Well, we will look forward to having you back next year when hopefully we're still your number one podcast and you can tell us what you've done next. With that, we're just going to take a quick pause whilst we hear from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneers of personal digital banking. They are reviving the vision of financial institutions being on first-name basis with customers by offering a platform for personal, human-centered services that put the customer first. Your customers experience immediate accessibility while your employees get cloud-based core-connected tools to offer service at the moment of need. To learn more, explore the team's latest insights at jackhenrydigital.com. Buy now, pay later. Is it a force for good or in need for heavier regulation? Whether you're team love or team hate, join the buy now, pay later debate at our After Dark event on Tuesday, the 15th of December. Get ready for a gripping debate followed by networking and the chance to win some awesome swag during our virtual bingo. Head to bit.ly/December After Dark to secure your seat now.
Okay, welcome back. Our first story for this second half is that Move has raised $27 million in a Series A round led by Andreessen Horowitz. Move helps businesses embed transactional banking tools directly into their apps, all while being flexible. It can be used with different bank software, for example. It closed the round off the back of a $5.5 million seed round back in August that was led by Matt Harris at Bain Capital. As part of the raise, Angela Strange, a general partner at A16Z, will be joining Move's board along with Harris, and the raise will allow Move to build out its suite to meet key client demands, for example, more methods for transferring funds. What differentiates Move, in large part, is that the technology it creates is open source, meaning it's freely available to access online on the code sharing website GitHub and open for discussion on a public Slack channel. So they believe that this is what investors got excited about. Move's open source community creates a highly reliable, down to the core primitive building block, said Angela Strange, since so many developers can contribute to the code. Wade, I'm going to come to you first on this one. First of all, congratulations again. I felt like we should all have champagne for this episode. Can you tell us a little bit more about this and you know what it's like to be welcoming two new people onto your board?
Absolutely. So we're obviously super excited about having Angela join our board and the entire team at Andreessen Horowitz. So Angela is wonderful. Peter Levine, who is on the board of GitHub, has also become a board advisor. And Seema is just one of the smartest people in fintech. So really powerful team that we're joining there, along with Ashley and Matt Harris at Bain Capital. So a lot of, these are two VCs that have been in this space for a long time and have seen kind of the underpinning problems that have kept some of their portfolio companies from scaling. And I think we're now 10 years into this fintech game, and there's now enough people that realize, hey, building a new go-to-market strategy on top of something that doesn't work ultimately, is a reflection on that brand. And so we've chosen a totally different approach to go after it with open source and an open community and having a ton of fun doing it.
What was it like within the investment process, kind of explaining your open source approach? Was it something the investors just got straight away, or did it take a while to kind of get your narrative across?
I think so. When we started raising money during COVID, I think that COVID made it difficult to explain the dynamics of the community, but have also allowed the community to grow. So having over 1,000 operators and developers in our Slack channel from all walks of life and all over the world is probably one of the more powerful pieces, because we've gone in 18 months from having nothing to probably the most reliable ACH, Wire, OFAC, Sanction Search, Image Cash Letter, ISO 20022, like these really nerdy protocols, right, that allow you to connect to the networks. The only way they can be hardened is through lots of transactions. And so a lot of the kind of incumbent legacy providers say, well, we've been running this COBOL code for 30 years, and so you should trust it. And we can come back and say, well, Square and PayPal and Bank of America and all these other companies utilize it and have run trillions of transactions through the open source libraries in the last 6 months. And so which one would you rather use? And oh, by the way, ours has test coverage and works in any cloud provider and all these other things that are pretty relevant in 2020.
So do we think that open source is the future then? I know that we've seen quotes that say as much. You know, there's one from Ben Metz from Jack Henry, who bought Move CEO's first business. And he said that in our Decoding documentary that open source platforms are going to be table stakes in the future and that no one is going to be able to keep their source private. Do we agree? I think Wade probably does, but I don't know if Kate and Alex do.
You know, where I think it's different is Alex and I have been in the software world for a while. So, you know, 20 years ago, we used to say we're built on, you know, the Windows.NET stack and we're using Microsoft SQL Server, right? Or this is built on Oracle Rack or, you know, Oracle Cube. And part of your software was we're part of this other ecosystem. And, you know, even in the late around 2010, people were still differentiating their product offering because they were in a cloud. You know, that we're running on AWS. Now you just kind of sound silly if you're not in the cloud, right? And so I think it's a progression of how technology works. I assume GoHenry doesn't have in their go-to-market strategy that they use, you know, Postgres or MongoDB or Oracle or Elastic or Linux or, you know, any of these underpinning technologies that allow them to different, you know, build their product and differentiate in the market. And where Move agrees with this momentum is that, well, ACH in the United States is 40 years old. The credit reporting standard is 90 years old in the United States. It's a flat file format. These are solvable problems that release a ton of value if every single startup doesn't need to go recreate them. And now it's up to the startup to decide, you know, how I'm going to orchestrate them, how I'm going to use them to be differentiator. And so it is critical infrastructure, but by no means is it a critical differentiator for anyone.
Wade, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
What is there an economic model behind? How does it work for Move? How will you make money? What's the plan there, if there is any?
So that is the number one question that every VC asks.
I have seen too many of them. Maybe that's why I'm asking this question.
So I think there's great models out there that value is created in multiple ways. You know, some value can be created in a proprietary technology stack, right? And this is our secret sauce. And, you know, if I'm an artificial intelligence company, you know, that's probably the right place to have your proprietary technology. But for infrastructure plays, we see open source being monetized in other forms of value, right? So let's use comps like Cloudera with the Hadoop ecosystem, Elastic with, you know, if you have autocomplete search and you're not Google, you use Elastic, a MongoDB, Confluent with Kafka. These are great models where the value creation that they provide is for developers to get to market faster. And in a highly regulated space, you know, us being able to provide SOC 2s, SLAs, indemnification, connections to the networks, all these pieces are really important for production. But for a developer that just wants to, you know, generate a payment file or check a balance on their laptop, you know, that's a better developer experience, but they also don't need it to work at Target or Starbucks at that moment. But in production, it surely needs to be connected to the real network and allow that to happen. And so we see that value creation in the security, the shared services, and all those pieces that go along with it. You know, the other pieces that most of our customers are very large at high scale. So they've got 10 million consumers or billions of dollars of money that they want to transfer. And so that's not the bank in the box model doesn't work anymore. They need to be able to work with their commercial loan officer, work with their technology provider, and really have more controls about around risk, underwriting and how that process works. And so we see most of our opportunities in consumers that are in that build versus buy. You know, there's not something off the shelf that they can just utilize as a turnkey solution. And their search normally starts at GitHub. I like to say we're the most popular fintech on GitHub. We may also be the only fintech on GitHub. So it allows us to differentiate in that way. So their developers are looking there and then they go, hey, you know, I don't want all this PII data on my servers. I want a dashboard. I want reporting. I want fraud mitigation. I want third-party integrations. And those are the pieces that we provide in our commercial products.
Well, it sounds like we are definitely going to be seeing more sort of people exploring the idea of open source, but we will be watching you closely to see what you do with that money. And we hope to have you back in 12 months as well to tell us, you know, how you've got on. All right, we're going to move to Singapore now. Grab, Singtel and Ant Group have won digital banking licenses in Singapore. So the four firms have been given licenses to run digital banks in the country in a move that would allow the tech giants to expand their financial services offerings. You know, Ant Group obviously being possibly the largest tech giant in the world, I would say it's probably fair to say. The nation's central bank, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, known as MAS, said it applied a rigorous merit-based process to select a strong slate of digital banks. As these digital banks start their pilot operations, MAS said it will review whether more companies could also be granted licenses. So two licenses went to a consortium between Grab and Singtel and Ant Group, and the other two licenses went to one entity wholly owned by internet giant C and a consortium of Greenland Financial Holdings, Link Logis Hong Kong, and Beijing Cooperative Equity Investment Fund Management. My God, what are they going to call their bank? They need to go snappier than that, I think. We expect them to thrive alongside the incumbent banks and raise the industry's bar in delivering quality financial services, particularly for the currently underserved businesses and individuals, said MAS MD Ravi Menon in a statement. A handful of countries, including the UK, India, and Hong Kong, have already streamlined their regulations in recent years to grant tech companies the ability to operate as digital banks. So thoughts on this one? I suppose digital licenses generally, or perhaps people have some specific knowledge about Singapore?
I don't have specific knowledge of Singapore, but this just reminds me of what we were talking about in Hong Kong not long ago. It still feels like a very similar process in terms of, you know, issuing these licenses and sort of rounds, similar sorts of numbers, I think, you know, when Singapore were, sorry, there you go, getting confused, Hong Kong were giving out their kind of licenses for these first digital-only propositions. I think, as you're saying kind of in the intro, Sarah, like some of the underlying companies that have been awarded them don't, obviously we look at Grab and Ant and get very excited about those, but some of the other ones where you definitely need to sort of wait and see what they've pitched to the authority as kind of their offer for Singaporean consumers. So, you know, we know that Singapore as a market is maybe not sort of underserved is in the way that we might expect sort of globally in other markets, but there are definitely sort of specific needs that consumers there have. And it's, you know, a market that people in the team have been working this year. So it's definitely an interesting space and one where I think interesting propositions will start to emerge anyway in the next couple of months, but this is only going to accelerate it further.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that two of the licenses, so Grab, Singtel and C, have got consumer bank account licenses, and Ant and Greenland Financials Consortium, which I'm not going to say again, you just have to trust me, it's that one, will serve, they've got licenses to serve small and medium-sized businesses. So I think it's really interesting, this decision to award equal licenses to an equal number of different types of licenses, because what we've seen perhaps in other markets, you know, the UK, for example, we saw the consumer banks sort of come through first, digital only, and then the SME banks sort of slightly follow on. I think it's, you know, my personal thought on this is that it's a good approach to see that even-handed distribution. What do other people think on this? You know, is it an interesting group of companies that have got the licenses? And also, do you think that dual focus on consumers and SME is the right approach to take?
What I'm excited about is, I mean, you're seeing this as a more global trend even, and the tech providers that are enabling better financial services. And you can't argue that even what Alex is doing at GoHenry is not a better digital experience for his consumers, right? And so across the globe, we're starting to see the definition of what a bank is change a little bit. In the United States, having somebody like Square Capital have a industrial loan charter, you know, having Varo have a charter, having Kraken, a crypto exchange, having a charter. I like seeing these new types of charters to allow access in a defined way into the financial services industry, rather than, you know, having this gray area that I think is a risk spot between the tech company and the financial institution when the tech companies get massive scale. So hope to see more of this trend in every global market. And I think it's going to ultimately just serve consumers better.
Alex, what are your thoughts on this?
I think this is a trend that will continue. I mean, COVID-19 will exacerbate the need to actually change the banking system when people cannot, I mean, a lockdown, you cannot go to your branch anymore. You have to do something digitally. So it's really good to see another regulator taking the step. I mean, they didn't start with COVID. That was prepared quite a few years ago. But I think this trend will continue. It just follows the changes in our lives. I mean, we see it at GoHenry. I'll just take one little example. During lockdown and COVID-19, we have seen a surge in the amount of money that was sent by grandparents to their grandchildren because they couldn't, of course, given the situation, they couldn't meet anymore. And so this is where you see that a small digital tool in the financial space can make real life better. So digitalization should not be seen negatively. It's always like a bit framed as, oh, this is bad for jobs, bad for society. No, it's what we do about it, but it's happening anyway. So better frame it as they did in Singapore or as they did in the UK. Better frame the future rather than be passive and let actors decide.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it's interesting about this is that they had, you know, 21 firms that applied. So obviously there's good interest. You know, there was interest waiting to be supported by this change. But, you know, 14 met the criteria, but then they've only decided to give 4 out in the first instance. So I think I don't know if they've released kind of the rationale behind that, but you know, you could assume that they want to kind of make progress, they want to move forward to make things easier, but they're kind of doing it in a way that they as an authority can monitor. You know, they're not just going to kind of throw out licenses left, right, and center and just like let the market kind of fight it out completely. They're going to monitor this and make sure that they can innovate and implement change in a way that will kind of counterbalance some of those fears maybe that you talked about, Alex, in the market, that digitalization is all bad. You know, they're going to work hopefully closely with these companies to make sure they're doing things responsibly and kind of using the license in the way that it's been intended.
I think that's the point, and that's why I think regulation-led innovation in areas like this is so important, because you have a twofold. One, you have the regulator who can keep an eye on what people are doing and check that, you know, customers or consumers, small businesses aren't going to be adversely affected. But two, on the other hand, I think it's quite encouraging if a regulator says, come on, we want to do this, guys, and we'll help you do it. It's encouraging for a market. It gives it sort of stimulus, and I think it can help stimulate innovation. I mean, I would say that I'm a bit biased. I'm quite a big fan of the FCA over here in the UK and their approach, and I think Maz looks like it's following a similar line. But yes, I think positive story. Yeah, Alex, final thoughts.
Yeah, when we say that regulation has to play a role, it also, again, it's always a nuance in everything. It depends on how regulators play the role. If it's an outcome-based regulation, where basically the regulation sets this is the outcome we expect you to achieve, the actors in the space, you do the way you want, but this is what you deliver. That's one thing, which is good. If it's like prohibitive, like if it just says these are like very restrictive and these are the actions you can take and not take, that's not good, right? So it's this balance between you have to do a frame. I think a frame helps, but the frame has to help the actors actually deliver what the regulator thinks is good for society or for the space. So an outcome-based approach is very important.
I completely agree on that. All right. Well, another one to wait and see, and we'll see how many more banks get licenses over in Singapore, if indeed any more do. We're moving on now to Deutsche Bank, which is going to move the heart of its IT systems into Google's cloud. So Deutsche Bank expects to ultimately replace large parts of its core banking system with alternatives powered by Google, as the German lender embarks on its biggest effort yet to modernize computer systems that have hampered it for years. Deutsche Bank and Google finalized a cloud computing agreement under which Deutsche plans to shift most of its data onto Google servers. Both firms also agreed to jointly develop products, including new lending offerings and retail apps. And the two companies expect to sell some technology that they develop together to other financial services providers as white label products and split the revenue. Exactly how much of its systems Deutsche Bank will move into Google's cloud will depend on legal, regulatory, and data privacy considerations. And the contract is set to last at least 10 years. And Deutsche Bank expects to make a cumulative return on investment of €1 billion through the alliance. That's quite a nice round number. I'm not quite sure how they got to that. It's interesting. I think this is a really interesting one. I think there's interesting commentary both on Deutsche Bank's decision and also, you know, to be talked about Google's move into becoming sort of a software provider for financial services. I think we've seen quite a lot of evidence of that lately, particularly, Kate, as you referenced with the Plex product. I think that's another signal that they might be going down that route. Wade, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. I couldn't be more excited about this. As somebody who was explaining to FFIEC auditors in 2008 what AWS was, I'm excited that in 2020 we actually have commitment from a global financial institution into a cloud provider. For me, you know, GCP or Google Cloud, their hiring of Yolanda Piazza, who is CEO of FinTech, to come in and start leading a strategy and for Google Cloud inside of financial services. This, you know, I don't have any insider information, but this just looks like the type of deal that she could put together. And each one of these cloud providers are continuing in the same way that, you know, mainframe providers needed to sell more services, more products. They need to grow revenue. I think we'll see continued capabilities from the cloud providers and make it easier and more turnkey for you to use their compute. So, you know, what a great win for Google. And super excited to see what other financial institutions start actually embracing moving, you know, the heart. I'm not sure what that means, but it seems like an important piece of the body into the cloud.
I was thinking, yeah, if the hearts move, where does the soul go? That's kind of what I'm
That's right.
Like, where's the soul?
That soul's still in a raised floor. No question about that.
I think, I was going to say, that got very philosophical very, very quickly, very deep there. I was just going to say that I think that's an important point because a lot of, you know, banks that have, you know, publicly announced putting services into the cloud, it's been peripheral systems. It's not been kind of core banking systems. It's been other things that sit around the edge. Alex, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think we will see more and more of this type of news in the coming years because high street banks are today squeezed, getting more and more squeezed between two forces that are really for them. They have to figure them out. One is there is a macro trend. Interest rates are low and will remain low for a decade. So the spread they are doing on lending is getting thinner and thinner. So their revenue margins are going down. So that's one pressure from the top. And then you have the pressure from the bottom where they are now more and more competing with competitors who have one-tenth their cost base. They will have to figure a way out. And in the UK, there is a third pressure, which is very peculiar to the UK, which is there is this political, agreement that banking should be free, right? So something would have to give at some stage if we want banks to survive. And so this type of deals for me is one of many to come. I don't know with whom will be the next, but Google, Microsoft, I mean, you name these companies who will actually help the banks cut their costs. That's for sure. That will come.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I think it probably will take one or two to take the plunge, you know, to go all in on it. And I don't imagine everything is going to go smoothly. But, you know, well done to Deutsche Bank for being, you know, one of the first to do that. And I hope it goes as smoothly as possible. So we do see more more in this vein.
Yeah, this kind of randomly, it's a bit random, but it reminds me many moons ago.
Where are you going?
Well, many moons ago, I had the privilege to go to Australia, and I remember going to a place where you could see penguins coming out of the sea and like migrating.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's brief, but the story kind of reminds me of that, because I feel all the banks are like the penguins that like on the edge of the water, like looking up at the sand, saying like, "Someone go for it." And as soon as one went, like all the rest went. So I'm kind of hoping that Deutsche are just the first penguin heading up the beach, because it's as Wade said, it's very exciting. And as Alex said, there's lots of pressures that have been holding them back legitimately, and there's lots of concerns that they've had legitimately. But yeah, I hope it's.
I think the penguin metaphors, I have to say, Kate, I'm loving it today. The philosophy and the penguin metaphors, they're winning. You're killing it. Wade, I will give you the final word, but I do now expect a penguin metaphor with it.
Well, penguin represents Linux and open source is the only way I can take that somewhere. But the number, to your point, Sarah, you know, 1 billion, that's a material number. I think it's common for startups to think about these huge IT budgets at all of the global banks and the billions that they spend and maybe the lack of innovation. But to Alex's point, you know, 10 to 1 is probably on the low side of the efficiency gain to go from owning physical data centers, mainframes, network security, and migrating that to the cloud. So it should be interesting to see if freeing up $1 billion, you know, what does that do for innovation inside of a global financial institution like Deutsche Bank?
Well, we can only hope for the best, I think, on that front. But yeah, absolutely, it's a multifold win there. All right, we're going to move on now as we're getting to the end of the show. We're just going to round up some of the other stories from the week that we didn't have time to cover, but we think still deserve a shout out. Kate, do you want to go first?
Absolutely. So first up, story over from TechCrunch. Facebook adds cart to WhatsApp to make shopping easier. WhatsApp said it is adding the new feature after early positive response from some businesses that tested this feature recently. Carts are aimed at making it easier for consumers to buy multiple items from a business and for merchants to keep a better track of order inquiries and manage requests. But one missing element is support for payments. You know, as of today, when a user places an order with a business on WhatsApp, both parties seem to be left on their own to figure out how the money will exchange hands. And WhatsApp hasn't had much luck with adding payments to its app so far. It was only recently that India permitted WhatsApp to roll out payments on its app to a larger subset of users. Brazil is the other market where WhatsApp rolled out payments this year, though the South American nation took no time in suspending the new service. Despite its gigantic reach, WhatsApp also makes little to no money, as the app is mostly free to use and ad-free. It hopes commerce will help drive up profit margins, but it stands to become a viable challenger to giants like Amazon and Walmart in emerging markets like India, where e-commerce is still at a nascent phase. So it's no surprise to see WhatsApp continue to evolve their commerce offering. I think on the last figures I saw, they had about 50 million businesses who were using the app to kind of communicate with their customers, and about 175 million people who were kind of messaging them on it. So it's a huge reach. But as we sort of touched on the main story, currently, as of yet, not really monetizing that super successfully. And this update follows on from a release in October where they announced Facebook hosting services to host businesses' online assets and activity. And they also said at that point that they're going to start charging companies for using WhatsApp for Business. So they clearly now feel like their business customers are sufficiently dependent on them to start ramping things up and trying to monetize them. But whilst it's definitely interesting, it does kind of feel like they're rolling out functionality in a much more incremental way than we've recently become accustomed to see from some of the other big tech giants, Google, for example, and the lack of simple payments functionality still feels like a massive gap. Kind of makes you wonder how much their original planning might have been structured around Libra or DM, as it's now known, and how they've had to adjust to the delays that they've experienced there.
Okay, well, the next story is that Mexican challenger bank Albo has raised $45 million to expand. Albo has nearly 500,000 customers across Mexico and a network of 30,000 retail locations where representatives can take deposits. It now has another $45 million to help it on its growth journey. So it's thought the company has a 40% share of the digital banking market in Mexico. CEO and founder said the money will be used to expand into lending and insurance products, as well as a range of services services Albo offers in a similar route to that of Brazil's Nubank. The company is trying to bring the middle and low income Mexican consumers into the banking system by making it easy for them to move from a cash-based world to a digital one. Which is why the company set up the network of 30,000 locations, including convenience stores and drugstores, so that it can accept deposits at the places where its customers frequent. So I think nobody who listens to this podcast is would be surprised at all to see more financial service providers in South and Latin America gaining funding, because it really is, I think, one of the hottest spaces in the world right now. There are an awful lot of people down there who are underserved financially and are still reliant on cash-based economies. But it's also, I think, one of the most complex parts of the world. You know, even within, you know, Mexico and Brazil, there are millions of different cultural differences and nuances. And then, of course, you know, if you're looking to try and work across countries or across borders like Nubank is, it becomes even more difficult. But I think, you know, we're going to see an awful lot more of this in this space. And my personal opinion is that it's too early to pick the winners yet, except that I would say if you're going to look at the continent as a whole, then Nubank is a pretty good bet. It's out there, the front runner. But, you know, as I said, each country has its own differences. And I'm sure we'll see leaders emerge across each different territory.
Cool. And the last story from CNBC is Revolut, Europe's $5.5 billion digital bank, if you've not heard of it, quietly broke even in November. So Revolut managed to break even in November, marking a strong rebound for the digital banking startup from the coronavirus crisis. Revolut's revenues dipped 40% in the early days of the pandemic, but are now 50% ahead compared to pre-COVID levels. Revolut's most recent accounts were released in August, showing the firm more than tripled its losses in 2019, despite a 180% increase in revenues. It's not the first time they've broken even. The company previously said it had done so in December of 2018. Revolut gets most of its income from interchange fees, which are generated each time a customer pays for something with their card. But it has been aggressively expanding into other areas of finance, such as investing and business banking. Whether Revolut can reach profitability depends on how fast we want to grow, said their CEO, Nick Storonsky. So I suppose the headline said quietly broke even in November, but it's not that quiet if we're hearing about it in the news. So I think it's interesting timing for this to get announced, given that we've been chatting about Starling hitting profit over the last few weeks. So not surprising that kind of Revolut want to indicate that they're kind of turning things around, especially off the back of such a difficult and challenging year in 2020. But as we touched on, I think it does need to be taken with a pinch of salt. You know, the most recent accounts show that they did triple their losses to, I think, 106 odd million pounds last year. So they've still kind of got a way to go before they become profitable in a sustainable way. And it's not clear precisely what drove the increased performance in this instance, but certainly the initial chat on the 11FS Slack was to kind of keep an eye on either the Bitcoin market and the kind of changes in the crypto offerings that they have built into the app. So they're definitely doing well to diversify, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so, and we'll have to keep an eye on what happens in 2021.
And finally, story. So a David Bowie coin has been launched towards space by the Royal Mint. So quite literally, the commemorative coin was launched celebrating the career of David Bowie. The Mint sent the coin to an altitude of 35,600 meters as it revealed the third edition of its Music Legends series. The 1 ounce silver-proof coin journeyed for 45 minutes at altitude before safely descending to Earth and is being offered at a competition prize. In recognition of Bowie's first hit single, Space Oddity, we felt it was fitting to send his coin into space and celebrate the Starman in his own pioneering fashion, said Claire McLennan from the Mint. The Mint said the design of the Bowie coin features the iconic lightning bolt motif, and thanks to the latest innovative technology and manufacturing techniques, the lightning bolt feature on Bowie's face appears to be laced with stardust to create a glitter effect. What a waste of money. Any other initial thoughts on this?
Well, I'm interested. We were chatting during the break, Wade, about kind of, you know, the different kind of monetary preferences of your children. You mentioned one of your youngest is keen on coins. So I wonder, would glittery coins be an even better thing, or would you think that would not land so well?
Well, she's six and everything Pinkalicious is perfect. So I'm sure she would love a glittery coin. And this goes to show that, you know, checks and cash are never going away as long as we have such inspiring opportunities to promote physical coinage.
Yeah, I really, I mean, I've never really understood commemorative coins. I don't know if this is a thing in the US, but here in the UK, they're launched and you have to buy them. So it's like you buy a £5 coin with like, well, there was a very famous one that had Prince Charles and Princess Diana's face on it when they got married. And I've never, even as a child, it never occurred to me to buy a coin. So I find the whole concept a little strange, but maybe I'm the wrong audience. I do like the glitter element, though. I will say I quite like a bit of glitter myself.
Yeah, there's a presentation that was done within our team recently by one of our characters in the team, Ellen, who her recommendation for gift giving was sovereign coins. So she thinks that's kind of an excellent gift to give for Christmas. So maybe sort of Bowie coins. I'll be interested to see if she adds that to her list of coins to give as gifts, but I think it's definitely interesting. I've got a couple of family friends who I saw in the past used to collect coins. It was always nice to get, you know, the books out and kind of look for, I'm a history geek at heart, so I love it kind of from that physical point of view and the historical point of view. But yeah, not quite sure what they're going to do next. Seems a little bit odd.
Alex, any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, Sarah, you said that was a waste of money. I think they could have wasted a little bit more money and make it really more fun. Call Elon Musk, who has sent his car into space with a spaceman in the car, and maybe they could target the mint so it gets there. That would have been really fun.
I think it's a nice stunt, and I don't think we should perhaps try and read too much into it. Okay, that wraps up this week's news show. Thank you so much to all of my guests. Where can people find out more about you, Alex?
Oh, the simplest is you type CEO GoHenry and you'll get to my LinkedIn. And the company is GoHenry.com.
Perfect. Wade, how about you?
You can find me on GitHub or Twitter at Wade Arnold, or come check out what we're doing at Move at MOOV.io, Move.io.
Brilliant. Kate, how about you?
I'm on LinkedIn. Sadly, you cannot type in CEO and my name and find me quite just yet, but just Kate Moody on LinkedIn. And I'm on Twitter at k8.moody.
Perfect. And you can find me on Twitter at Sarah Kachansky. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you've heard, do subscribe to the podcast and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps to make it better and it helps others to find the show. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can find us on social media. Just search for 11FS or FinTech Insider, or you can email podcasts@11FS.com. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.